Side, more than 85% of people got the intestines right and 80% knew where the bladder belongs. But of course, that means that 20% whiffed when it came to locating the bladder. Okay, fine. Many people, at least in England, don't know their anatomy. So what? Well, for one thing, the study's results were about the same as a similar study done in the 1970s. So over the past 40 years, we've gained little ground in educating people about what's inside the body. And it seems reasonable that knowing more about what's inside us and how organs work is generally a good thing. But more importantly, how much or how little we know about anatomy can affect our health. Other studies have shown that, given the general ignorance of anatomy, doctors shouldn't assume that patients understand what their organs are and how they work, even when a patient is being treated for a diseased or failed organ. Does knowing more about the body translate to people making healthier life choices? It's hard to say, but more anatomical knowledge certainly can't hurt. This Moment of Science comes from Indiana University, with production support from the Office of the Provost. Today's program was prepared by Jeremy Shear, with help from Valerie Dean O'Loughlin in the Medical Sciences program. There are hundreds more Moments of Science on our website at amos.indiana.edu. I'm Don Glass.
Book mentors come into the classroom and they sit with the children and they do a lot of one-on-one reading, which the children really do look forward to. We appreciate the Book Mentor Project because it does focus so much on early literacy for children.
He's very excited about the books that WILL sent home. As soon as he comes home, he says, "I got a book," and he takes it out of his book bag and we probably read it I'd say a good 10, 11 times before bedtime. He loves to read the books.
I think WILL's Book Mentor Project is a wonderful program. It allows our children and families and community and teachers to work together to ensure that children are ready for kindergarten.
His cheeks were blushing red.
I'm Kelly Russell, and WILL is my source for extending classroom learning.
It's 2:43. This is the Afternoon Magazine. There's afternoon baseball in St. Louis today, where the first-place Cardinals are playing host to Florida. Joel Piniero is trying for his 15th win of the season. The Cards' magic number for clinching the NL Central is 10. They've lost four of their last five games, however, and today in the top of the fifth, Florida leads St. Louis 4-0. The Chicago Cubs continue their series with Milwaukee tonight with Rich Harden on the mound. The Cubs have won 7 of 8 to keep their National League wild card hopes alive. They trail Colorado by 4 in the loss column with 19 games to play. The White Sox have moved within 5.5 games of Detroit in the American League Central with 17 games to play. They'll try to close the gap a little more tonight in Seattle in the second of 3 games with the Mariners. And Jake Peavy makes his long-awaited first start for the Chicago White Sox on Saturday at home against the Kansas City Royals. The Sox gave up 4 minor leaguers to acquire the right-hander from the San Diego Padres at the trading deadline. Peavy has not pitched since June. That's sports.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Tepper Electric, Champaign, The Andersons, Champaign, Trainer Grain and Supply Company, Forest. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
One man who has been trying to study the economy is the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke. He said yesterday the recession appears to be over, but he cautioned the economy probably won't grow quickly for a while, and unemployment is likely to remain high. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Economists have been predicting that the long, painful recession would probably be finished before the end of the year. But this was the first time that Bernanke himself said it may actually be over. He also struck a note of caution.
Even though, from a technical perspective, the recession is very likely over at this point, it's still going to feel like a very weak economy for some time.
He said the rebound in growth would probably be moderate through next year because of ongoing headwinds in the economy, like tight credit conditions. And he said without strong growth, unemployment will be slow to fall. He said it will come down, but it will take some time. Bernanke made the remarks at the Brookings Institution in Washington during a question and answer session on the first anniversary of the collapse of Lehman Brothers. The remarks came shortly after the release of a Commerce Department report saying retail sales rose at their fastest rate in 3.5 years in August. The report suggests that consumer spending may finally be reviving, but economists cautioned that the rebound was partly because of a one-time-only boost from the Cash for Clunkers program. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
President Obama spoke to Wall Street's financial community on Monday. Yesterday, he had a different audience, auto workers at a General Motors small car plant in Ohio and a big AFL-CIO convention in Pittsburgh. The president pointed to workers being called back by GM as a hopeful sign for the economy. He also said a health care overhaul is a critical part of long-term economic security. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
The president is both defending his economic policies and pressing for a health care plan that has a tough road ahead in Congress. At the Lordstown plant, he cited the government aid General Motors got without using the words bailout or takeover. Instead, he spoke of the benefits workers are already seeing thanks to that and the Cash for Clunkers program.
Because of the steps we've taken, this plant is about to shift into high gear.
He noted that Lordstown Assembly went from 3 shifts in the summer of 08 down to 1 shift this year, but is now preparing to bring back more than 1,000 workers in a few weeks to work on the line building the Chevy Cobalt small car.
And next year, this plant will begin production of the Chevy Cruze, a new car that will get more than 40 miles per gallon. I just sat in the car. I asked for the keys. They wouldn't give me the keys.
42-year-old Marisola Gonzalez was among a group of a dozen workers who sat down for a private discussion with the president at the plant.
About what the president had to say. You know, I think he realized how important the car industry is to the U.S.
But she also said Mr. Obama didn't sugarcoat his answer when he was asked about the prospects of bringing back to the U.S. the manufacture of all kinds of products that are now mostly built overseas.
He, you know, tried to make the point that some things could never be made in America and sold because the labor is so cheap in other countries. You know, their way of life is so much different than ours, or so, you know, lower standards that some things can never be made in America.
But she said the president told them that what can be made in America should be and will be made in America. From Ohio, the president flew to Pittsburgh in the AFL-CIO convention, where today Richard Trumka takes over for the retiring John Sweeney as the president of the nation's largest labor federation. Mr. Obama proudly called himself a friend of the House of Labor as he spoke of the current difficult economic climate.
So I know times are still tough for working people. I know too many people are still looking for work or worried they'll be the next ones let go. But the Recovery Act is making a difference. We've stopped our economic free fall.
On health care, polls show that Americans with coverage are concerned that they might not like changes that are made to the system. The president told this union audience that they're already making trade-offs. They can't negotiate pay hikes, he said, because of the rising cost of their health plans.
That's not just the fault of the employer. It's the fault of a broken health care system that's sucking up all the money. When are we going to stop it? When are we going to say enough is enough?
The president came here to fire up his political base. The labor movement was a key element of his election. Now he hopes to harness it as he spends the fall fighting for the top item on his domestic agenda. Don Gagne, NPR News, Pittsburgh.
People have been staying away from some theme parks recently. In Orlando, Florida, Universal's Islands of Adventure hopes to lure them back with something new. It's called Harry Potter and the Forbidden Journey, a ride opening next spring. It's part of the wizarding world of Harry Potter. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
I've never heard or seen anything like this before. I think it's going to be completely unprecedented, and it's just really going to be amazing.
No, Emma Watson, who plays Hermione Granger, wasn't at the news conference on Universal's new Harry Potter section. She was there on tape. Tom Felton, who plays Draco Malfoy, did turn up. And it wasn't so much of a news conference as a promotional webcast aimed at building interest in the world's first Harry Potter theme park attractions.
As you enter the Wizarding World, you first come upon Hogsmeade Station.
Using a specially designed for Universal version of Harry Potter's Marauder map, producer Paul Dorio described what visitors will see when they enter the area.
To your left, you pass Zonko's, the joke shop, and Honeydukes, the sweet shop, where you can purchase an array of jokes and gags and sweets, including chocolate frogs and birdie bots.
Universal's news yesterday was that the Wizarding World of Harry Potter will open in Orlando next spring, although that's a pretty vague timetable for families trying to make travel plans. It's reported to be a $200 million-plus project. It will cover 20 acres and will feature three main rides, or attractions, as they call them in the theme park business. Universal creative president Mark Woodbury says fans will be able to visit the shops, walk the streets, and see the scenes created by J.K. Rowling and made iconic in the Harry Potter movies. He calls it an authentic, immersive environment.
And that extends all the way through Hogsmeade with the three broomsticks and Ollivanders and the Hogshead Pub. You know, really go into these iconographic moments in the movie and turn them into real experiences. That's really the great challenge for us.
To help ensure that authenticity, the art director for the theme park is Alan Gilmore. He's also the art director for the Harry Potter films. He believes the most impressive part of the Wizarding World will be Harry's school, Hogwarts.
It's going to be the Parthenon of Orlando, I think. It'll be the great big temple which people want to come and visit. It's going to be a real edifice, aged to look like it's been there 1,000 years. It'll be an extremely different kind of castle to the Disney castle. It'll be a much more European, very real, based in fact.
Keeping up with Universal, Disney just announced plans to rework the Magic Kingdom in Orlando. Robert Niles, founder and editor of the website ThemeParkInsider.com, says Disney is adding a Little Mermaid attraction and building areas that will focus on heroines like Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty.
It doesn't have quite the cross-generational appeal that Harry Potter does, but Disney princesses are an extremely powerful franchise with a lot of fans, and Disney connects with a lot of people, and I think it's going to be quite successful for them once it's open.
That won't be until 2013, which means in Orlando, next year could belong to Universal and its main attraction, Harry Potter and the Forbidden Journey. The company won't say much about the ride, except that it will sweep visitors along a journey that captures experiences from the books and films. Niles says it's expected to be an innovative ride that's already created a fair amount of industry buzz.
It is codenamed within the development community as Project Strong Arm, because they are using robot arms. If you've ever seen pictures of assembly line where they have those robots arms coming in and fixing the cars, well, just bolt a row of four seats to the edge of one of those, and you've got these robot arms which are going to be placed on an elevated track going through the Hogwarts castle.
For Universal, the opening of the Harry Potter section next spring comes at a good time. The recession has been tough on theme parks, and Harry Potter is expected to help boost attendance. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
It's 2:53. The Environmental Protection Agency has a new water-saving program called Water Sense. It's similar to the Energy Star label for electronics. To get the Water Sense program's endorsement, toilets must use less water. But people have been complaining about the old-style, low-flow toilets since they were first required in the mid-1990s. Lester Graham reports on what's changed since then.
The problem with those old low-flow toilets is many of the companies didn't really redesign them. They just made the tank smaller. So they didn't do the job. Hugh McGuire has one in his home. He's had a bad experience with his.
Let me just say, I don't want to, get into disgusting details here, but I probably had to flush my low-flow toilet 6 or 7 times. What is that saving you?
Doesn't save you much water that way.
Doesn't save you much water at all. Plus, it's just annoying, and it's embarrassing because, everybody's hearing you flush the toilet 6 or 7 times. Wonder what the heck's going on in there.
So we asked Matt Grokoff with Greenovation TV to set up a demonstration for us. Behind the Be Green retail store in Ann Arbor, Michigan, 3 different models of these new WaterSense low-flow toilets are set up on 5-gallon buckets so we can see what gets flushed and what comes out.
I always joke there was 3 things that set back the environmental movement. There was the original low-flow shower head, the original low-flush toilet, and Jimmy Carter sweater, because what that said to everybody was that you were going to pay more for it, it was going to be less comfortable, and you were going to have to sacrifice, and it wasn't going to perform as well. And with these new generations of redesigned toilets, you're getting a higher quality product than even an existing 1.6-gallon or 3-gallon per flush toilet.
Let's see it.
These toilets all have dual flush capabilities. A full flush is 1.28 gallons. A half flush, just 0.8. To prove how well they work, Matt's just using the 0.8-gallon flush. He's got tennis balls, potatoes, and little rubber duckies.
We got 3 duckies.
Well, that seemed to work. No duckies. What'd you think of that, Hugh?
I felt sorry for that ducky, but it was a great demonstration.
And again, that was the half flush at 0.8 gallons, half of what the old low-flow standard was. Matt, up the ante from there.
Got 2 tennis balls and 2 potatoes. This is going to be the real challenge.
Then more potatoes. And more duckies. Matt's demonstration is hardly scientific, but of the 3 brands we tested, a Kohler, a Church, and a Caroma, it appeared to me the Caroma worked best, at flushing duckies and potatoes anyway. Rudy Wilfong is a dealer for Caroma. The toilet is made in Australia. He says Australia has had a 1 gallon per flush restriction for 30 years, so they've designed them to work.
And they don't plug. They flush better than 1.6 gallon toilets with half the water.
And compared to the old low-flow toilets, you can expect to save about 1,000 gallons per person per year. They do cost more, but the payback compared to a regular low-flow is about 2.5 years. If you've got one of those 3-gallon per flush models or even an old 6-gallon model, your payback will be a lot faster.
All right, Matt, I'm going to give you one more chance to impress me. What do you got here?
All right, so here we've got a full T-shirt. Very nice.
Hey, Matt, I had a black T-shirt. Did you see it anywhere? Well, this is pretty impressive. Where can I get some more information about this?
Of course, you can go to greenovation.tv, and you can see a video and some photographs of some of these toilets.
All right, Matt Grokoff with greenovation.tv. Thanks very much.
All right, thanks, Lester.
For the Environment Report, I'm Lester Graham.
Earth and sky.
Natural photosynthesis uses natural materials, living materials, and artificial photosynthesis uses man-made materials.
You're listening to Harry Gray, professor of chemistry at Caltech. He's using artificial photosynthesis to make solar fuel cells. Just as plants use sunlight to make their own energy, Gray believes his solar fuel cells could one day create enough fuel from the sun to provide the energy humanity needs.
So nature has already given us the example of what we must do.
In place of a leaf, Gray's team is building a tiny solar device to capture sunlight. The energy of the sun is used to split water into hydrogen and oxygen to create hydrogen fuel. He said these solar devices could carpet rooftops or operate in the middle of the ocean. They'd